There, one and all, welcome to this edition of the Weekly Chat with Ralph and me, of course. We're going to talk about two things today. One is the current crisis in the diamond industry. And secondly, we are going to talk about the curse of 35. sounds like a movie. But anyway, I'm Peter, he's Ralph. Let's do this.
Let's do this.
So first of all, first up on the menu, current crisis in the diamond industry. So there was a really interesting, there's a very interesting article in, what was it, Financial Times, talking about the output for the diamond business of Anglo-American falling significantly. It was talking about, one of the reasons for it was for the reining in of luxury spending. But the other thing was the increased prevalence of man-made diamonds. Now, this is something I mentioned quite a while ago, the lab-grown diamonds. I think I mentioned it in relation to Pandora, the Danish jeweling chain, the jeweler chain. And basically, they were saying that they only wanted to have man-made diamonds. You know, it's cheaper. It's better for the planet. So what's not to like is essentially the argument there. Now, I guess Ralph and I sort of gone a stage further than that and thought, actually, well, if that's the case, what's the point of mined diamonds? And what's gonna happen there? Because if you can get a diamond, more diamond for less money, then what's the point? And you can't tell the difference between a man-made one and a natural one. Then what's the point of going for a natural diamond and paying loads more for it? So, what do you think about this, Ralph?
Yeah, well, I've been looking at this topic for perhaps a month or two, and the reason is that my wife expressed interest in lab-grown diamonds.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay.
And so we discussed this, and that's kind of the reason why this appeared on my radar screen in the first place. But I'm actually amazed by this. First of all, it appears to be the case that lab-grown diamonds, LBGs, I think they're called.
Yeah.
Another acronym to learn. That LBGs are indistinguishable from mined diamonds. Mm-hmm. And that really means indistinguishable to the naked eye, of course. Mm. But also, if you got your jeweler's microscope out, as you would at a posh cocktail party, and examine somebody else's diamonds, you would still not be able to see the diff.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure maybe some technology has been devised which would allow you to tell them apart, but of that I'm not sure. So to all intents and purposes, a lab-grown diamond and a natural diamond are identical. There is one important difference, however, and that is the price. So I don't even believe that I am exaggerating if I say that you have to pay, let's say, $30,000 for a 2-carat natural diamond and $2,000 for a lab-grown diamond of exactly the same weight, exactly the same cut, and exactly the same quality. Now, if I get the same item and I can have the choice to pay £30,000 for it or £2,000, well, what would I choose? I mean,
and they look the same. This is the thing. They look the same.
Well, that's the point. They look exactly the same. You cannot tell the difference.
You are literally just wanting to spend money for the sake of spending money if you're going to buy the more expensive option, aren't you, really?
Exactly. And this is where I'm going with this. And this is a question mark in my mind because I don't know this yet. I've watched some videos and some interviews with jewelers from and employees from De Beers. So I'm getting a sort of inkling of what the answer might be. But let me first of all ask the question. So my question would be, is there in fact any motivation left for anybody to buy a natural diamond. If there's no if about it, as they are identical in looks, in quality, in, well, in weight if you choose, in cut, and therefore in the sort of sparkliness of the accessory which you're getting, then the only reason which would theoretically be left to opt for a natural diamond is a certain snob value. But this is almost, if it existed, it's sort of the essence of snob value, because the only thing there is for you, the purchaser, to know that it is a natural diamond, because nobody else can see it. And you're hardly going to advertise it at a cocktail party shouting, I have got a natural diamond for which I paid $30,000. Your diamond is LBG and you only paid $2,000. To which the other person would say, yeah, and think who the stupid one is now.
Yeah, exactly. Because he'd be sort of saying, well, my diamond, I got some bloke to go down a very dark hole to dig something out with a pickaxe for me.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
It's like, that's the other thing, isn't it? One doesn't know exactly how these things are mined. I mean, I'm willing to believe, for the sake of argument now, that all diamonds which are mined by reputable companies are mined in accordance with ethical guidelines and workplace conditions, but of course we don't know. But let's just assume that's not quite an issue. But you're right. I mean, there's that issue is in the background. But so basically, if I look at some of these videos and some of these interviews which I hear, then employees in the mining, but in particular in the sort of retail jewelry industry, when faced with this very question, why would I buy a natural diamond? They are scraping at the bottom of the barrel. They don't really have anything to say. They're sort of squirming around a little bit, and then they say things like, these are only always blokes. I mean, there's a certain amount of sexism here as well, by the way. It's sort of the idea that the man buys a diamond for his whatever, betrothed or wife or something. So there's an element of that as well. Let's acknowledge this, but that's not the point. So the interviewees say things like, well, when a man buys a diamond for a woman, you want it to be special, and especially what are these things called? Wedding, it's not wedding rings, engagement, it's the other ring. Thank you. Especially if it's an engagement ring.
The other thing.
The bit before the thing especially if it's an engagement ring, then you're marking a very important point in your joint life, and you want to make this special. But none of that makes any sense. Well, it is special. I mean, it's a diamond. It sparkles. It's lovely. And so I think you guys all know where I'm going with this. I don't believe that there is any reasonable, compelling argument left to buy a natural diamond, other than perhaps for some, the pride of ownership, the knowledge that it is natural. But that's a very flimsy thing. It's not as if you're talking about, let's say, Ferraris, and there's pride of ownership, and you own the Ferrari rather than own it through a timeshare. There's an element of that. There's pride of ownership, sure. I mean, can I understand it to some extent? But this is not present here. This is purely ephemeral, if that reason existed.
I mean, you know, one of the things could be, let's say, owning a fake Rolex versus owning a real one. You know, you're sort of, well, look, it looks the same.
Yeah.
But if you look at it closely, it's not the same. It might be lighter. It might tell the time more reliably than a real one.
it doesn't say Rolex, it says Bolex.
Yeah. Actually, by the way, on that subject, when I was in Japan, I went to this marketplace. Sorry, this is a bit of an aside, but hilariously, they had these fake Rolexes, And they looked okay until you looked at the word where you normally see Rolex, and it said Rorax, R-O-R-A-X. And you're thinking, ah, that's where they've gone wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you know, like something like that where there is actually a difference. Mm. Or let's say people wearing fur coats, right?
That's a good point, yeah.
At the moment, you know, if you see fur on someone these days, you assume that it's synthetic.
Yes.
But if you really wanted to be snobby about it, you could say, oh, feel the fur coat. This is real, not like that man-made stuff. And then you could feel it, and you probably could feel the difference. Mm-hmm. But with something like diamonds, you can't.
No, you can't see or determine the difference, even if you had a jeweler's microscope.
I know, what's it called? There's a word for it, isn't there? But the thing.
Oh, I'm sure there is, but it doesn't matter. You know what I mean. Even if you whipped that out at a cocktail party and examined, as I said before, the other person's jewelry, you would still not be able to tell the difference. And that's not because your eyes are not good. That is because the two objects are, in fact, identical. Mm. And so, where would this go then? Like I said, I've looked at some of these prices. I didn't make this up. For a 2-carat one, natural, $30,000. LBG, lab-grown, $2,000. 1 carat, it's about $10,000 versus $1,000. So we're talking easily a multiple of 10 times and more for this. So in a very simple and still simplistic calculation, if you think about the jewelers, De Beers or whoever, who might have a revenue line of 100, I mean, these are illustrative numbers just to illustrate the dynamic, is 100, and you have a 10% margin, so you make a profit of 10. Whether obviously, if lab-grown diamonds come on the market, extend their market share, then your revenue number might collapse, in fact, up to a factor of 10. And so now you're not making 100 anymore, you're making 10. If you're able to maintain the same margin, which is not going to be possible because a lot of your costs are going to be fixed, not variable. But if you were able to maintain the same margin of 10%, now you make a profit of 1. Previously, you made a profit of 10. Like I said, it's going to be less than 1 because a lot of the costs you have are not variable. They are fixed. They're not going to move. Mm-hmm. And so if I was an analyst, a very simplistic way, obviously, the value of your company would drop by a factor of 10, probably more. Now, there's more to this, and this is why this hasn't quite happened, but the value of these companies have dropped. And the only way to sort of counteract this trend, it seems to me, for the diamond industry, would be to invent some non-tangible thing, some marketing gimmick, some idea that attaches to natural diamonds, which puts into the buyer's mind the idea that natural diamonds, albeit they cannot be distinguished from LBGs, are somehow better. You know, because the argument which you brought, the comparison with fur, is brilliant. But there is one, perhaps, element there which is different. I mean, if you take a mink coat, I mean, this is not going to be very nice to the minks. We know this. And society has moved towards, I believe, a level of, let's say, intellectual maturity to understand that and to try to avoid needless cruelty to animals. So if you were to say, ooh, fear this, this is proper mink, probably people would say, ah, well, you're a bit strange. I'm going to sit at a table as far away as possible from you. Now, that may be present in the case of mined diamonds, as well as we just mentioned, but to the extent that they are fairly sourced, and we can believe that element of sort of ethical doubt may not actually attach natural diamonds to the extent that I believe by now it does when we're talking about real fur. And so to the extent that it doesn't, it would then allow the diamond industry to create this marketing gizmo to create this intangible idea that natural diamonds are still somehow better, although it is never going to be able to define exactly how this how this is. And that may be something which we're going to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that with with this, you know, marketing can do some amazing things that are completely illogical.
Yes.
I mean, I was looking before that, because before this, you know, we've recorded this, we had a bit of a chat about this beforehand, and I was just checking a few bits and pieces. But apparently, so De Beers has famously said in its marketing campaigns that a diamond ring should, an engagement, diamond engagement ring should cost three months of, worth of salary.
Yeah, I remember.
Well, apparently back in, was it the 1930s, it was 1 month's salary. And over the years, it has developed into 2 months and then 3 months' salary. Now, marketing has done a brilliant job of doing that.
Exactly.
There is absolutely zero logic to any of that.
Yep.
But they have, because I suppose the thing is, they've fed into the fact of how much should one spend, you know, and the general gist of the fact that most people don't know anything about diamonds. I mean, I remember when, you know, I got an engagement ring for my wife. I remember I didn't know, you know, it was a complete revelation about, you know, cuts, color, clarity,
yes,
size. I didn't know any of this stuff, and most people don't in their general, you know, course of life until they have to do it, and then suddenly what do I spend, you know, and that's what they feed into.
Yeah.
You know, and marketing has done other things as well, you know, around the world to convince us of all sorts of rubbish. Like, for instance, one of them, you know, one of the ones I often like quoting is in Japan. There's a holiday called White Day, right? Which is on March the 14th. So it's exactly 1 month after February the 14th, which is Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Now, apparently early in, I don't know, 1930s or something, Japan started, because it's inherently, it doesn't celebrate, or it didn't celebrate Valentine's Day. It started celebrating Valentine's Day, and apparently some, you know, traditionally on that day, without going into too much detail here, women give men chocolates. That's the tradition, right, on Valentine's Day in Japan. But then some confectionery company invented essentially another one, which is the answer to that, called White Day, which is on the 14th of March, where the blokes give the women chocolates. And I think it got White Day, something to do, maybe they, I think they started doing white chocolate or something like that. Anyway, the point of that is completely manufactured, no reason at all for it, and yet it caught on. Same thing, Alibaba runs something called invented something called the Singles Day, which has now become the biggest one-day online shopping event in the world. It's way bigger than Black Friday. I think it's way bigger than Black Friday, Cyber Monday, and all the rest, all put together. It's so big. And that was, again, completely fabricated. It was something from something in the early 90s. Some university in China, I think some dorm, they had a load of single guys. They wanted to celebrate their singleness or something, or do market in some way. Mm-hmm. It started then, and Alibaba, for some reason, decided to pick up on this in the late noughties, and it's exploded to become this. It's all marketing. And so the thing is, I think that the clock is now ticking.
Yeah.
On De Beers to come up with some BS that people are going to sort of believe, and then hopefully they are going to keep their business.
I was as skeptical as I am. It's going to be possible, isn't it? Because diamonds, they do carry this. In economics, there is this concept of anomalous demand.
Yeah.
The more expensive, the more demand. And this obviously is only the case for luxury goods. And it's everywhere. We know this. I mean, I keep telling this story, which I'm not going to repeat. It's that thing with the clutch bag for debts, oh, yeah, which I wanted to buy, which cost like £15,000.
Yeah. I can see this affected you deeply.
What?
This affected you deeply.
It did.
You definitely
mentioned
it. Yeah.
I mean, it was 15 years ago. Blimey. Yeah. I mean, it did. Yeah. Okay, anyway. Fine. But you're quite right. Marketing, clever marketing, is capable of creating tenuous psychological links between objects and values which do not exist. They are being created. And the evidence for that, we all know it. It's all around us. Perfumes is another one of these weird things. A perfume is as ephemeral as it gets. It's just a scent, and it just lingers. You don't even know the carrier of it. It's just there. So why should I, for example, pay, by the way, I don't know this, but let's say Davidoff Cool Water existed, this was £20 or something, and Chanel number something cost £100. Well, I mean, is it really tangible? Can I derive the value difference of 5 times from sniffing the air that carries this scent? I would be skeptical. And then there are other things. When industries get saturated, then exactly what you just said happens. The retailers invent marketing markers, which then act as a opportunity or occasion where you have to buy something. One other such example is exactly the industry for wedding rings and engagement rings. Because 10 years ago, I think, jewelers invented the concept of an eternity ring. And I'm thinking, well, but I said to the bloke in church when we got married, it was going to be for eternity. In fact, he was quite insistent that I say that.
Yeah.
Who is this thing?
It seems that, yes,
the eternity aspect of it should really be in the covered ring which I just purchased.
Yes, it's like, I've already got it covered. It's fine. Exactly. We don't need it.
I got that covered. I got that covered. Absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, so I mean, in the end, I don't really have much more to say to this. I do believe that potentially the invention of lab-grown diamonds and the vast price differential for an object which is indistinguishable to the naked and the microscoped eye should really crater the jewelry industry. The only reason I wouldn't is, in fact, if the jewelry industry, the likes of De Beers, etc., are able to create a marketing gizmo that creates an intangible link, a psychology, which somehow would make it desirable to still buy a natural diamond. And even then, I'm going to remain cynical, because as the two objects are actually indistinguishable, you need a certificate to certify that something would be a natural diamond. Well, I'm sure these things can be faked, and I wonder. I just wonder
what you imagine that though. Someone saying, carrying around their certificate the whole time, saying, "Oh, nice ring." Funny you should say that. Hold on a minute. Let me get out the certificate. Here we go. It's like, But I think, you know, it, like you say, logically, this should mean the end of the diamond industry, really. But, you know, I think there's still a reason for the, you know, marketing and advertising that can really help. And, you know, this isn't going to be something that's just a load of influencers with their diamond haul. You know, like, hey, look what I've got from Pandora, and just doing that. I mean, there's probably going to be that, and there probably has already been that already. But this is changing, really got to change your mindset. So.
I mean, it is definitely going to shake up the jewelry industry. Pandora is a very interesting point, because Pandora, they make things which look good, and which are interesting, which are a bit novel, and which are affordable. And so why would you not actually buy that? And perhaps there is going to remain a sort of elitist group of people who will spend a premium for an intangible psychological benefit, which they're getting, the knowledge that it is a natural diamond, whatever that might mean. But I am pretty sure that we can expect margins and valuations of jewelers companies, and in fact everybody has got anything to do within the value chain of diamond production to deteriorate very materially.
We shall see, won't we?
Yes.
I mean, what was it? So synthetic diamonds will be to natural diamonds what AI is to, you know, many industries, I would say. Maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. Could be.
So anyway, let's move on and let's talk about the Curse of 35. Now, this I thought was absolutely fascinating. I did not realize this, but apparently in China, when you hit your mid 30s, you are judged to be, especially in the tech industry, you're judged to be over the hill, past it, bus pass fodder. and one of the reasons is that it's thought that you're not able to keep up with the 996 schedule, which is working from 9 till 9 p.m. By the way, all of those quiet quitters out there, think about this one, right? So working from 9, the expectation you'll work from 9 a.m. till 9 p.m., 6 days a week, hence the 996. I mean, you know, the reason is you become a parent, your body starts aging, and it probably most importantly, from an employer's point of view, you cost more to employ.
Yes, correct.
So what is happening at the moment is that Chinese workers in tech companies are reaching the age of 35, and then they're getting very, very nervous as they approach this age, because they think that if they then get culled at that age, it's extremely difficult for them to find something else, certainly within tech, but in other areas as well. Like, for instance, there was a something that said here about how council, I think it was council jobs or something like that, or civil service sector, you're not allowed to even have the application for a job once you've hit, I think, 35. So your employment options narrow significantly. Now, I would say that this is interesting. So in China, there's discrimination laws for gender and various other things apart from age. Age is the one that is noticeably missing from there. Now, I would say that, I have been a headhunter in the past for a number of years, and I feel that there is inherent ageism within society. Now, I know that a lot of people talk about the youth end and the opportunities at the younger end of the scale, but I would also suggest that actually there's possibly, there's arguably an even more serious problem at the other end of the scale, because from my time, headhunting, and okay, it was in finance, mainly investment banking. There were so many really good people that got made redundant at the wrong time, or they just almost made it to the next stage, but not quite. And it feels to me like certainly between the age of 35 and 40, it's a bit difficult. But it's not too bad. You hit 40, suddenly it becomes a lot more difficult. 45, a lot more difficult. 50, nigh impossible. I mean, it's an awful thing to say, but I felt that there's a lot of discrimination against the older workers, because employers don't believe them. This the most common thing I used to have was people saying to me, look, you know, I've got a house, I've got my other stuff, my kids are grown up now, so you know, they're just about to leave uni. I just want a job. I just need a job. I don't need to be the boss. I don't need this. I don't need the salary that I got. I just want to work. And you'll get employers that will sit there and they will nod and they'll say, yes, we agree, okay. And then they just go for the younger person because they don't believe that someone who was, let's say, more senior on more money is going to stay at a job. But people do. And the problem is that I feel that society does not really give them a chance. And so, you know, going back to this curse of 35, I think that the only way to actually get past this is by legislation and or quotas. But what do you think about that, Ralph?
Yeah, it's actually a surprisingly difficult subject because, first of all, we need to sort of examine whether it's true at all, whether you are past it.
Yeah.
You know, when you hit 35. I mean, certain jobs, let's say, yes, there is an inbuilt necessity to be young, but these are jobs like professional football players or the sports people are probably the only discipline I could think of. There is a very odd thing for professional mathematicians where the word is that no mathematician really generates anything worthwhile past the age of 40 or 45 or something. In fact, the most reputable medal or award which you can win in mathematics, the Field Medal, is only awarded for people who are younger than 40 because it's sort of baked into this. You know, past 40, wow, you're basically brain dead.
Yeah.
And you can actually go and teach multiplication tables at school or something.
Yeah,
That's all you're good for. But barring these extremes, even admitting that they may be true, I mean, I don't know this, I haven't examined this, but you think that the dynamics are as follows. When you're younger, this one which I'm about to say, that is true, you don't have as much as experience as a person who is older. I think we can objectively say that's the case. But what you bring, one might assume, is more motivation, more energy, not necessarily because you're young, but because you have not established yourself yet. And so there is this motivation also from purely practical points of view. You still need to actually achieve financial security, maybe for a family which you already have, for yourself, in order to found a family later. And so these years are the years where you're going to be hungry, and then they are sort of gradually replaced by a life age where perhaps you do not have that motivation anymore as much, but you compensate for that through the growing experience which you bring to the job. But at some point, you might say there's a tipping point where experience is not going to offset lack of youth, for a better word, anymore. And if that dynamic is true, and we can agree that it exists, then every employee as an individual would probably responsibly have to think about, well, if I hit or when I hit these kind of life ages, then presumably I need to transform my job away from something which is dominated by technical work towards something which maybe is in the managerial arena. And that may all be true, but that's not quite what we're discussing here, because we're not discussing personal responsibility and how to actually navigate these waters. What we're discussing here is corporate policy and an employer who basically says, past 35 in China for software engineers, past any other age limit which you might subjectively determine, you are no longer able to be a valuable employee. And so that to me is arbitrary and cannot be condoned. Now, would the quotas, I don't like quotas. I mean, quotas to me almost exacerbate the problem, because when you say, let's say we need to have so many, and now there are sort of all manner of factors which come in, men, women, white, green people, people who are 1.80 meters tall, or whatever other criteria you might actually select as being meaningful. If you say that we have to have so many people who conform to a particular rating factor X in the company, then from a social point of view, maybe before you formulated that particular stipulation, you didn't see these people. And now all of a sudden, now you see them. Now you see, oh, there's a woman. Oh, there's a black person. And maybe previously you didn't even notice that so much. So that's one thing. But the other thing is obviously also that you have to have a sufficiently large workforce for you to be able to actually diversify in this way. Mm. And lots of SMEs just don't have enough people to be able to diversify across these kind of rating groups. So don't think that's the answer. I think the answer is just simply to include age as it is done in most of European legal spaces, as much as I know, in non-discrimination laws. You can't discriminate against sex, religion, etc., and also not against age. And I'm surprised that this is not actually the case in China.
I mean, I think that this is a very difficult problem. And again, if you're thinking, well, populations, I mean, China is a prime example of this. You know, where populations are aging. Well, it's all very well, you know, sacking people when they hit 35. What do you do with the rest of their life? You know, I mean, do they all become delivery drivers or something? I mean, you know, is that the wisest, is that the best use of their experience and knowledge? I mean, I don't think so. And I just think that the problem is that for society to actually change the point of view and then be more open-minded to employing older people, then, you know, it's not going to work. And I, like I say, I think there will have to be some kind of change in the law to make it relevant from now onwards, rather than waiting for society to change its mind over the next 10, 20 years. But yeah, it's very difficult. It's interesting in the, you know, for the Chinese tech sector. And yeah, I mean, it's something that we all need to think about, particularly as, you know, like Japan, aging population, everywhere, you know, all these advanced economies, aging population. If we don't stop this discrimination against older workers, it's just going to get worse and worse, because you're going to get these people that aren't going to be able to, you know, support their own pensions. So they're going to, more of them are going to, you know, maybe have state pensions. They're going to claim more from the state, and there are fewer younger people at the other end to pick up the tab. So it just gets worse and worse and worse.
It does.
So something has to be done, I think.
And it would also act as a disincentive to enter these professions in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about China now, not European societies where mostly anti-aging laws are implemented. But if you think about, if you're a Chinese bright university graduate in a numbers-based discipline, and you wish to go into software engineering, you sort of almost know that you have a 10-year career ahead of you, and then you passed it. Now, if I knew that, I wouldn't actually go into this type of industry in the first place. I would choose one where I can basically be pretty sure that at least I'm going to have 30 years of gainful employment in varying degrees of responsibility in the company. And especially in countries which are the sort of up and coming countries in the tech world, like China and with a gap India, you would think that these are the sectors which are going to have to be supported for these countries to make a difference and to garner the growth potential which they have. So it seems slightly more than slightly strange that China is doing this is if they're shooting themselves in their own foot, because clearly there will be this disincentive for young people to move into software engineering. Or in fact, worse, from China's point of view, they're all going to go to America and work for the tech companies there, which is possibly also then why we see lots of Chinese nationals in our universities here in the UK, but also, of course, in the universities in America.
Mm. Well, there you go. I mean, I think that it's almost a bit of a, ending on a bit of a philosophical note there. It's a very difficult problem. Again, one of these things that you think, you increase quota, or you do something, sounds simple, but it's not, and it takes a long time. But I think that unless more is done, it's actually going to end up costing society very dearly. And it's not something you can implement overnight.
Yeah, I agree. That is a very interesting way to say it, because I think you're right. It's costing society dearly. Any form of discrimination against any group in a society is costing that society, if you think about it, because it deliberately decides not to garner the potential that members of these groups have to contribute constructively to society. And why would they have any less capability of doing this? You know, it seems completely silly to, always has been completely silly to me, to discriminate against anybody in a society. Of course, from a liberal point of view and a philosophical point of view, absolutely, but also from a pragmatic point of view, because you weaken your economy if you do that. And so you're right, I would agree.
Well, there we go. what a lovely moment to end. We both end in agreement. Thank you very much indeed, as always, Ralph, for your insight and experience.
As a very old person. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. Really appreciate it. Have a great day, whatever you're up to, and we will say goodbye.
Absolutely. Thanks, guys, for listening. So, thank you.
Thank you. Bye.